This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, an analysis of Donald Trump's victory. What does it mean for the fortunes of the Black misleadership class? Is this the last chance for TPP, President Obama's corporate rights trade bill? And the Black is Back Coalition holds a national conference on self-determination.
But first, we spoke with Dr. Cornel West, Black America's most prominent public intellectual. Dr. West was a key supporter of Bernie Sanders during the Democratic primaries. When Hillary Clinton won the nomination, Dr. West endorsed the Green Party's presidential ticket. We asked Cornel West if he was surprised at Donald Trump's victory.
I didn't think that he would win. I had a feeling it would be close, but I didn't think he would win. But I think that we are witnessing the end of the neoliberal era. It just did not go left populist. Following Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein, it went right-wing neo-fascist. But the neoliberal era is coming to a close. The neoliberal establishment is being exposed in ways that the populace now are highly suspicious of it. So the issues of class now are becoming much more central. But they're primarily talking about the white working class male, because that's one of the major social bases of Trump's campaign. But I think we have to be very clear about what it means to be on a terrain which is now post-neoliberal. And we were hoping it would go left. It has gone right. It's dangerous right. It's a neo-fascist right. But it does also mean that the left has a chance to tell some truths and realign social base to get at some of those white working class folk who have gone right wing as opposed to left wing.
That's already we hear some folks who were Clinton supporters saying that all that's necessary is to prepare for a reversal of the situation 4 years from now. Is that an adequate response?
I tell them to get off of the neoliberal crack pipe, that the neoliberal era is over, that the collapse of the Republican establishment, the collapse of the Democratic establishment are very now in place. And either the Democratic Party has to realign itself to an emerging left populist orientation, or it will more and more be pushed to the margins. The Republican Party now is quite, ironically, they're claiming victory. But Trump has destroyed the Republican establishment. So it was a certain hypocrisy. He went against the right-wing Republican establishment with his own neo-fascist language and rhetoric. So that I would hope that the Democratic Party can wake up. My hunch it probably hasn't. I think we need a third party at this point. Very much what you've been talking about, though, brother. A social democratic party, a left populist party. That's really what we need. It has to be multiracial. It has to put class issues at the center alongside of issues of white supremacy and patriarchy and homophobia. But the neoliberal leadership of any color, white, black, red, and so forth, has been exposed to be the failure that it is.
You know, the response of the electorate, including that went for Trump, is variously interpretable. But to some of us, the vote looks like a big FU to those who rule right now.
Oh, that's true. I think you're right. But it's just that Trump's social base goes from hardcore white supremacists and xenophobes and homophobes and anti-feminists to working people who were looking for a way out. They were going to give the finger to the establishment no matter what. And once Bernie Sanders' campaign came to a close, they had nowhere else to go. Unfortunately, it didn't go to Jill Stein the way we would have liked. But it is definitely a middle finger to the establishment.
And we ought to also be hearing a lot more talk about alternative ways of voting instead of this winner-take-all kind of situation that prevails in the United States.
Well, the thing is, I mean, again, you know, that Hillary won the popular vote and lost the Electoral College. And so Michael Moore's point about the Electoral College standing in the way of the will of the people is a very good point. But even still, though, I think that in so many ways, you know, the real deeper question is the need for a realignment, because it's very clear that the Democratic Party now is in profound crisis, and the Republican Party is in profound crisis, and you simply have this neo-fascist who transcends both of them with a language that appeals to enough voters to win with the Electoral College.
Big Labor spends big bucks, although it does not seem to exercise real influence within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I tell you. Yeah, Big Labor ought to be ashamed going with neoliberal Clinton so quick with no serious concessions, and now finding itself way on the margin. We had that struggle during the primary. I don't know why Big Labor didn't go with Bernie Sanders. It ought to be shame.
So are you sensing a genuine rethinking among folks who, in the end, on Tuesday, went for Clinton?
We shall see. But one thing, the bottom line is this, that if any new party does not deal with the vicious legacy of white supremacy and Black Lives Matter, then it's going to fail.
And Black Lives Matter, for the most part, did not endorse any candidate in this election cycle.
That's right, because they understood that both of them were so radically insufficient dealing with the crucial issues that Black Lives Matter is concerned about. And, of course, it's not just the issues of police brutality, police murder, massive unemployment, underemployment, insufficient schools, decrepit housing, but also what's going on in the Middle East, issues of Israeli occupation, issues of military presence, U.S. military presence expansion in Africa. That platform, the Black Lives Matter, has an international vision. And both candidates, of course, fall miserably in the face of that kind of vision. So I can understand why they didn't go with any candidate. I wish they had gone with Jill Stein, but that's another issue.
Donald Trump said at various times that he was against regime change, although he was not quite consistent even in that. Do you think folks in Syria may be having a sigh of relief?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with Donald Trump is he's out of control and in over his head, so he can't take seriously hardly anything he says, because it's going to be a question of what he does. You know, he may end up being very, very pro-imperialist, pro-regime change, because he doesn't know what he's doing. He just doesn't know what he's doing.
And from what we know of the people who will make up his cabinet, well, what kind of emotion should that inspire in us?
That's right. My hunch is he's probably going to bring in some real, raw, materialistic folk. And in that sense, he'll be similar to Hillary. So at that point, you know, all the rhetoric about trying to get along with Russia and not interested in regime change and so on will just go. Because when you're a novice and you're in over your head, you can get easily used and manipulated by the experts. And if he brings in these neoconservative militaristic experts, then we are in deep trouble. We got more wars.
And that would be a change without a difference.
That's true. That's exactly right. But let me say this. Let me say that the Black Agenda Report, during the neoliberal era, one of the few sites for truth-telling, when people write the history, they got to go back to you and Bruce and Margaret and the others. Now that that era is coming to a close, and what's going to happen is we're going to end up with a whole lot of comrades who are against Trump, against the neo-fascist projects, and say, you know, we've been comrades all along, even though we didn't say a mumbling word about some of these crucial issues during Obama's period, you see. And you say, oh, really? You better quit lying. We know where you stood. We know you didn't stand for truth and justice during the Obama administration, during the neoliberal era. But they're going to now be on fire and probably get radicalized, because the Trump election, the Trump victory, is a massive wake-up call. So many of the voices in the wilderness, like Black Agenda Report, will become now much more important and popular, because people are hungry for the truth. They've been sleeping during these last 8 years. They've been sleeping. didn't want to say anything about the issues of class, about the issues of drones, about the issues of surveillance. And now with Trump in the office, they're going to be freed up to want to speak some truths.
And our brother Ajamu Baraka, who was an editor with Black Agenda Report, and of course, the vice presidential candidate with the Green Party, will be back to the work that he was doing before.
That's right. He's a towering truth teller. Brother Baraka, the towering truth teller, and his voice will be more needed than ever. And that's true for you all across the board. That's true for Mumia Abu-Jamal and a number of folk who held on.
And for you too, brother, there was a time when it seemed that there were folks who were trying to cast you out of the House of Blackness.
That's well put, brother. I was out in California. Man, I had 4,000 people show up at a lecture. And the brother came up to me and said, Brother West, man, if you knew the names that I called you 5 years ago, you would slap me upside my head. He said, but now I'm with you 100%. I want to thank you and so forth. And I'm seeing that all across the country, brother. And when they say that to me, they're saying that to you. They're saying that to Bruce. They're saying that to Margaret. They're saying that to Mumia. They're saying that to Carl. It's right across the board. And all we're trying to do is just love the people and tell the truth and bear witness and die.
That was Dr. Cornel West.
Dr. Anthony Monteiro, the Du Boisian scholar and activist from Philadelphia, was one of the few observers on the left that thought Donald Trump might win the election. Monteiro says Trump's triumph is a result of the political crisis in the ruling class.
First of all, I don't think anyone could have predicted the type of slam dunk taking down of the Clinton machine that occurred on Tuesday. I thought that there was always a possibility that he could win the election, and a lot depended upon the way he conducted himself in the campaign, but also external events such as WikiLeaks and things that no one could have predicted, such as the FBI revisiting its investigation of the Clinton emails and the server and that type of thing. But no one, I don't think, could have predicted what actually happened. That is, for example, 53% of white women voting for Trump. That didn't seem to be in the cards. 52% of workers in organized labor voting for Trump. No one could have predicted what role the Haitians in South Florida might play, and I think they played a role that we still have not calculated in shifting Florida, clearly those in a very slim manner, towards Trump. Nor should anyone see what we now, in a preliminary sense, know, that 13% of black men would vote for Trump, or that in places like Philadelphia or Detroit or Flint or Cleveland or other large cities, there would be a significant falling off in the number of black people who voted. Now, all of that having been said, it was apparent that there was a deep anger at the neoliberal elite. There was a deep sense of anxiety and uncertainty among working people and the poor about the stagnation of the U.S. economy and the failure to produce jobs, represented in the fact that more and more of the working class were dropping out of the labor force altogether. People felt that the government was rigging the numbers about unemployment and rising wages. So all of this conspired to produce what I first saw as an insurgency. And I was, you know, I felt that the insurgency would grow and deepen, but I never thought that it would become what I think it became on last Tuesday, a insurrection. And as I said before, the roots of this are so deep that Election Day would only be the beginning. And that's what we saw. In a certain sense, white working and poor people in these small Rust Belt towns and cities kind of have a sense of confidence and achievement in having brought the Clintons down that black people had in 2008 when Barack Obama was elected with this huge black turnout and these huge numbers voting for him.
Most of us know what we think we know about people in communities other than our own through the media. But the corporate media was almost 100% behind Hillary Clinton this time through. Was it that they did not hear what white folks in the Rust Belt and elsewhere were saying, or were they too busy screaming their Hillary message at people?
Well, I think both. I mean, they were going to make Hillary the president no matter what the people wanted. So the project of the corporate media was to make invisible and to silence black and white suffering and to present this image of progress that had been made over the last 8 years under the Obama administration. In the life world of most people, no matter what racial group you identify in, there has not been this kind of mourning in America, this great progress. And I think the neoliberal, managerial, and technocratic class lives in a bubble of gentrified, high-rent urban communities on the East and West Coast. They have utter contempt for the poor. They have utter contempt for white working people. So they did not see them. They had literally erased them from the social and political landscape of the country. They didn't make a difference. And they were so accustomed to them doing what they were told to do. And I think, you know, in terms of black folk being told what to do, it was kind of symbolized in the ways that Obama campaigned among black people for Hillary, pointing his finger at us, using degrading terms like cousin Pookie, and this type of not just pandering, but demeaning and dismissive behavior, saying to us that if we didn't vote for Hillary, that he would take it personally. All of this was symbolic of a narcissism, of a selfishness, of an egotism of this ruling managerial elite, which is linked to Wall Street and to the war makers.
Donald Trump wrecked the Republican Party in the process of getting its nomination, and some folks think that's a very good thing. And the Democratic Party almost split with the rebellion from Sanders supporters, leaving a weakened Hillary Clinton. What's the duopoly look like?
Well, I think that both parties, at the level of their leadership, are demoralized. The takedown of the Clinton machine, which in effect is the Democratic Party. The takedown of the Clinton machine has thrown the Democratic Party into chaos. There are multiple trends and factions competing for dominance. You know, Bernie Sanders is pushing Keith Ellis, the black congressman from Minnesota, to be the chair of the DNC. I'm certain there will be pushback from people connected to the Clintons, such as Wasserman Schultz and McAuliffe and those type of people. I don't think the Republican Party can even call itself a political party. It is a fiction of a political party at this point. I think you have the Trump Party, which will be fought every step of the way. I know that already there are those from the neocons who were with Clinton who are trying to make overtures to Trump. They might be successful. We don't know. But the Republican Party is hardly a party at this point. I don't know whether you heard that John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, had planned to make a speech on the day after the election. And he assumed that Trump would lose and would be defeated soundly. But the speech had to be torn up. and the occasion had to be canceled because Trump won. And where does that leave Kasich and his wing of the Republican Party? Or Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio? Where do the Bushes fit in? Where do the big funders like the Koch brothers? And on and on and on. I don't think we are looking at, going forward, a duopoly in the ways that we have seen it in the past. Now, this raises another huge problem. Can the country be governed under these circumstances? In other words, are we approaching a situation of ungovernability of the nation?
Yes, some would describe that as a crisis of legitimacy. In fact, you spoke of an impending crisis of legitimacy previously on this program.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I think it is. And I think it is a deepening crisis of legitimacy. And it is not just the political structures and the politicians. It is a crisis between the people and the mass media. There is a crisis between the people and the banking system, between the masses of people and what we call the 1%. I think the country is not only in a crisis of legitimacy, of the principal political, cultural, and social and informational institutions of the society, but I believe because of this crisis of legitimacy and because of its intensification, we are now approaching a situation where the country cannot be governed in the ways that it has in the past. In other words, it becomes increasingly ungovernable. This is hugely important going forward, because a country that cannot govern its people cannot effectively be an empire and an hegemon in the world. In other words, the whole notion of the single hegemonic superpower is also facing a crisis, not only because of the international challenges from places like Russia and China and the Philippines and maybe Turkey and who knows where else, but because of the fact that the people of the United States do not see the foreign policy, the military ambitions, and so on, of the single superpower, as it is called, as something worth supporting. And therefore, the crisis of legitimacy of the ruling elite within the United States helps to intensify a crisis of legitimacy of the U.S. empire.
Yes, internally, neoliberal capitalism has not been able to provide any incremental benefits to its people in decades. In fact, incrementally, things are taken away. There are losses every decade. And now it doesn't even make promises to improve folks' conditions. So how can such a regime continue to claim legitimacy?
It can't. It can't. And I think when you're hitting on the ground of the whole political crisis that we're experiencing, and it's grounded in the economic crisis that begins in 2007 and has not ended. And in fact, this election and the election of Trump might be that external push that produces another stock market collapse, which could lead to another great recession, and thus to another round of protests and struggle. I think that the economy is a central issue that elected Trump. The rejection of the economic policies of the neoliberal elite, and I think because the economy is so fragile that the same dynamics could lead to a new upsurge of what we would have to call class conflict within the nation.
Now, in terms of Trump's foreign and domestic policy, TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, appears to be dead almost on its own without Donald Trump having even been sworn into office. But Could you imagine a situation in which Donald Trump would be able to push through Congress a law that would collect 35% tariffs from U.S. corporations that imported foreign-made goods?
I don't think so. I think that Donald Trump, on all matters of neoliberal globalization, as well as on matters of military and foreign policy, will be fought by, and I put quotes around this, his own party, because the Republicans in the Senate and the House are not a part of the same party that Trump is the head of. In other words, the White House, after this honeymoon is over with the Republican leadership of both houses, after this honeymoon is over, they're going after Trump with long knives. And so perhaps we will see not a honeymoon of the type that Hillary Clinton would have been given, especially on matters of trade and foreign and military policy. The Republican leadership in the House and Senate would have supported her on those things, and that would have been the framework of the initial honeymoon. But I don't think Trump is going to have that honeymoon. The Republicans are going to fight him. Now, this does not rule out, however, a major split and a major struggle among Republicans in the House of Representatives. And that might center upon a fight over the leadership of Paul Ryan. And then the next question becomes, where do the so-called progressive Democrats in the House of Representatives come down on questions, let us say, of foreign military and foreign policy and trade, these international trade deals? Would they support a renegotiation of NAFTA? We don't know. But what I am suggesting is we are going to see a political battles of the type that none of us have seen in our lifetime, and probably we have not seen since the time of the Civil War.
And we must talk about the Green Party, which only got to 2 or 3%, and the possibilities of party building, both electoral and parties that spring from social movements as well in the wake of Trump's victory.
Oh, yes. I think the Green Party is one of the three pillars of what I've called this insurgency, this political insurgency over these last 16 months. And they are the Bernie Sanders insurgency in the Democratic Party, which is still alive, the Donald Trump insurgency and takedown of the Republican Party leadership, which is still alive, and the Green Party. It's really heroic effort of Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka. Cannot be underestimated. And I think they played a huge role in the defeat of Hillary Clinton. In that respect, the Hillary Clinton people are right that the third parties did damage her more than they did Donald Trump. And that's a very interesting equation, because what we saw was a movement of progressives increasingly away from Hillary Clinton. That, to me, explained the 53% of white women who voted for Trump. Now, among that 53%, there are large numbers of feminists who, in a broad sense, are considered progressive. The other thing is that there is a correlation, at least in the data that we have gotten thus far, that communities, white communities, that voted for Obama in 2012 shifted in 2016 and went with Trump. Now, I say all of this to say that there was in this broad Trump coalition not only the right wing and the racists and white supremacists, but there were progressives or liberals, if you will, who had in the past supported Barack Obama and the Democrats. And I think on economic issues, broke with the Democrats. Now, the most loyal group, even though our numbers were diminished in terms of turnout and percentages voting for Hillary Clinton, still the most loyal group were the African Americans. The question becomes, what will become of the African American movement in this new moment? I think there will be class dynamics and class conflict and ideological struggle and struggles for leadership that will reach a new intensity in this period. The Black misleadership class, again, characterized by its narcissism, its selfishness, its materialism, its basing its practices upon celebrity and that type of thing. The Black misleadership class was severely wounded in this election period. The vote against Hillary and the fact that Black people refuse to go with the same passion with her that they went with Obama suggests that the Black misleadership class does not have the political strength that they claim to have had. And I think this opens up new spaces for new leadership, for new ideological configurations going forward. And thus, the Black left is in a better position now with the takedown of the Clinton machine and the Black misleadership class by implication. The Black left is in a better position now than we would have been if Hillary had won.
Dr. Anthony Monteiro is one of the organizers of a conference on political science for radical times, December 9th and 10th in Philadelphia.
Congress opened its lame duck session this week. It could be the last chance for passage of President Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership corporate trade rights deal. Donald Trump made defeat of TPP a key goal of his campaign. Hillary Clinton claimed she also opposed TPP, although nobody believed her. Kevin Zeese is with Popular Resistance, which has been fighting TPP every step of the way. We asked Zeese if Trump's win at the polls spells doom for Obama's pet project.
It definitely affects the environment, the election outcome. I mean, the Democrats, if they had won Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, Hillary Clinton would be president. Those states in Ohio and Indiana were all won by Trump. And that's the Rust Belt that was destroyed by NAFTA and was going to be threatened by TPP. And that all went to Trump. If that had gone to Clinton, we'd have a different outcome. And the impact in Washington, D.C. is an already dying TPP before the vote is now looking like it's on its deathbed. Both McConnell and Ryan are saying we're not going to vote on it. Obama is saying he's still going to push for it. But it's looking like Obama's going to hit a brick wall of a soon-to-be Republican Congress and current Congress that is going to follow Trump's lead on the Republican side. And a bunch of Democrats now know from the election results that trade is an issue. And we've worked for 5 years, over 5 years on this. And one of our goals has been to make TPP stand for toxic political poison. And that seems to have happened. Not only did both Hillary and Trump say they oppose the TPP, so did some key senators, and so people changed their positions to meet up with the views of the public. And so it's a toxic political environment for the TPP and maybe the rest of Obama's trade agenda. And we have some very targeted protests that to make the point. And, you know, we're hoping that in the midst of these protests, Obama faces reality and decides to announce he will not be pursuing the TPP. If that happens, the protests will turn into celebrations, but we'll continue to protest to go to both the Republican National Committee and the Democrat National Committee and other key areas and demand that the people's views be listened to. Trump won as a so-called populist, a billionaire oligarch populist, and the Democrats lost because they had an elitist in running for office, not a populist. And so populist power showed itself in this election, and we're going to demand that incoming President Trump live up to his promises to make peace with Russia, not continue to escalate U.S. wars. We're going to push him to, when he repeals the Affordable Care Act, to replace it with Medicare, expand Medicare to cover everybody. Trump has spoken in the past about supporting Medicare, that Medicare needs to continue. And he has in the past support about health care for everybody through a single-payer system. So we're going to push him on that and a whole series of other issues. And we'll also be pushing the Democrats to wake up and realize that they have to start listening to people, not to their money. So that's where we are. We're hoping for a TPP victory and then pushing forward with people really demanding their agenda.
Now, Donald Trump, of course, was against TPP, but he was an outlier in the Republican Party, which historically has been even more in favor of corporate trade rights and privileges than Democrats, going back to NAFTA, certainly.
No question. The corporate trade has been a favorite of Republicans. They, of course, use the fake name, the propaganda name, free trade, but it's really corporate trade that empowers corporations. And, of course, Sanders advocated for, he's always been on the right side of trade, always opposed these corporate trade agreements. And that really is what forced Clinton to come over to oppose the TPP, which she had previously called the gold standard. But no one ever trusted her on that turnaround. And at the end of the election, WikiLeaks gave us the reason why we didn't trust her. A memo from John Podesta talked about how Clinton had told another member of Congress that she only opposed TPP to get labor off her back and that she would revert to supporting the TPP once she became president. So her two-faced private perspective and public policy perspective showed itself in these WikiLeaks documents on the issue of the TPP.
What I'm getting at here is that even though Donald Trump opposes a TPP and these kinds of deals, he would have to provide some leadership to get other Republicans not to support not just TPP, but these other deals as they come up during his presidency.
No question. The Republican Party has already been moving in that direction. You might remember that during the fast-track debate, fast-track trade authority debate, there were about 50 Republicans who were opposing fast-track. John Boehner twisted arms, the former Speaker of the House, twisted arms to force Republicans to support fast-track. They got just enough votes to pass it. But then John Boehner basically was kicked out of office by the Freedom Caucus because of how he twisted arms on that issue of fast track. And now you see Paul Ryan in a very precarious position for a couple reasons. First, there was a poll of Wisconsin dairy farmers, his home state, that found 80% opposed the TPP. And he also has a problem with the Freedom Caucus, which is the Tea Party members, who many of them oppose the TPP because they see it as giving away U.S. sovereignty to other nations and to these fake courts, these trade tribunals. And so Ryan needs their support to keep the speakership, and he knows that Boehner lost because of that. So already we're seeing pressure. Now with Trump winning, and winning in the Rust Belt in particular, where trade is an issue, those five Rust Belt states gave him the presidency. And so we're seeing now McConnell and Ryan both saying, we're going to let Trump lead on this. And so they don't think there'll be any votes in a lame duck session. So that's really positive. Now, of course, we see Obama still pushing, so we have to make sure that it doesn't happen. But Trump has created an environment that are actually built on an existingly moving in our direction environment that opposes these corporate trade deals because it's really undermining the U.S. economy, and that's what got Trump elected.
And who are the Democratic champions of corporate trade deals? Obama's leaving the scene, and Hillary Clinton reversed herself and, of course, has suffered a stunning defeat.
That's right. And there are a number of 2 to 3 dozen Democrats who voted for fast track trade authority in the Senate. A really key player in the Democratic Party is Oregon's Ron Wyden, who is the ranking member of the Finance Committee, which is the most important committee in the Senate that deals with trade. And so he's a big headache for us. He always kind of plays the middle on it, but in the end, he always comes out in favor of the trade agreement. And so I'd say Ron Wyden, who won his reelection relatively easily, I would love to have seen him challenged more aggressively, but he won re-election pretty easily, and he'd be the key guy in the Democratic side. And now that you have the Republicans coming into control, he's really the leader on this issue for the Democrats, and hopefully he'll see the lesson from the election and begin to go back and change his position and support what the people are saying, which is we don't want trade rigged for big business that undermines the economy at home.
So all in all, November 8th was a bad deal for those who want corporations to rule the world.
Well, on this one issue of trade, now, of course, I expect Donald Trump's view on why he doesn't like the TPP is one that really wants more corporate power. He wants better deals for U.S. corporations. Now, when there were leaks about TPP from WikiLeaks that showed where the various countries stood on these issues, the United States was way to the right as far as the issue of giving corporations more profits, more power, compared to the rest of the countries that were involved in the TPP, which were much more center and left on that issue. So Trump's, you know, stops the ratification now and thinks he's going to renegotiate, he's going to have a hard time. That last negotiation almost didn't happen. It was a real nip and tuck discussion, and finally agreed, but it was not easy. And if he's going to go in there with even more pro-corporate, even worse than Obama, who was really bad, a more pro-corporate agenda, he's going to have a hard time getting other countries to agree. There may not be a TPP ever in our future if they seek to renegotiate. It'll be like the WTO since the Seattle protest, which has been pretty much stagnant, unable to reach agreement on anything significant. We may be in the same situation with TPP. It fails. They try to renegotiate and can never actually reach agreement. And it also looks, just by the way, there's some reports that the EU agreement is finished, as is TISA, the Trade and Services Agreement, that all these, this whole Obama trade regimen may be in serious trouble.
That was Kevin Bean of Popular Resistance speaking from Baltimore.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations last week held a national conference on Black self-determination in Washington. Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela outlined the coalition's 19-point document on applying the principle of self-determination to the whole range of political issues.
Everybody wants self-determination, but what does it mean practically? How can we go out in the world and fight for it? What would we fight for when we fight for self-determination? Well, one, point one says we're fighting for Black women. Point two says we're fighting for the Black family. Point three says we're fighting for Black community control of the police. Point four says we're fighting to free all political prisoners. If you had no other idea of who this man Barack Obama is, the fact that there are Black men and women rotting in prisons right now who fought for the freedom of Black people, or who, like Assata Shakur, is hiding for her life in Cuba after the Obama regime placed a $1 million bounty on her head. $1 million was already there, and Obama's regime's added another $1 million to it. If you didn't know anything else about Obama, you know that he hasn't opened up the files to tell you exactly how they killed King, exactly how they killed Malcolm X, exactly how they murdered Patrice Lumumba with a white CIA agent, Lumumba's tooth in his pocket. Number five, we say roll back and end mass Black incarceration. Six, reparations, reparations, reparations. We want a payback. And I'm tired of them white people running and say, oh, y'all just want the money. Damn right, we want the money. We want the money, all of it, every penny. And you must want it too, because you ain't giving it back, right? Number seven, self-defense. We declare our human right to armed self-defense from the violent attacks by white citizens and the assault and murders by domestic military occupation forces. You heard that sister who spoke yesterday. This white man just blew her son away. And now he's out on $20,000 bond. And nothing is supposed to happen to him. Eight, we said nationalize the banks and end forever the rule of capital. Nationalize the damn banks. We said number nine, full employment and a national minimum income. We didn't say $15 an hour after a number of years, maybe. full employment and a national minimum income. Y'all know that the government don't create money. They might have printing presses and stuff. They do not create money. They do not create value. They do not create wealth. You know where value comes from? From production. And what you're talking about, who has produced more than anybody on earth, the concentration of wealth that has come from the enslavement and colonization of black people. It didn't just go away once slavery was formally over. Every computer you see, every tall building you see the concentration of the wealth that came from picking cotton and clearing the swamps of this country. Black people did that. And so we say we want a right to housing that is safe, secure, habitable, affordable, with freedom from forced evictions and the process of redlining traditionally used to deny housing to black people. We demand reparations for the loss of billions of dollars in black wealth due to home foreclosures stemming from the U.S. government-supported subprime mortgage scam. You know what? You can't get that on the Democratic platform. You know why? You know, one of the reasons you can't get it is because this scam that they call subprime mortgage, you know who created that? A white woman named Penny Pritzker out of Chicago, a billionaire who is now in the Obama administration, but who was his campaign financial chairperson when he ran for office. And Obama gonna cry crocodile tears to you because you lost your home. I'm upset. So, a halt to gentrification. And I just think we ought to begin to call that by its proper name. You know, because they get away with stuff when you get gentrification. That's something that's so hell. You know, it's like forced population removal. They move us every time they have an economic interest to do so. They move us from this community to that community. And so we have no stakes in this community or that community. We say number 12, black businesses must be nurtured by public development banks and protected from strangulation by corporate chains and monopolies. Number 13, right to free education through postgraduate level, free education. And I think what's really important for us to understand is black people created the public education system in this country. It was after slavery to make sure that we had education during Reconstruction when we were in place, we created the public educational system. And now we are the ones who are kicked out, you know, can't have access to it. And if you do have access to it, it's something that would turn you into another Obama. And free, universal, quality health care for everybody. That's a public system that serves the health needs of entire communities, as well as individuals. If we say, given that group health outcomes are closely linked to group political and economic status, past and present, a universal healthcare policy must provide both equal care to all, regardless of social and financial circumstances, and restorative care to historically oppressed communities, which requires political self-determination to achieve social and biological wellness. Voting rights, we believe the right to vote is a fundamental right, but beyond that, the right to have something to vote for. And so we demand the use of proportional representation voting systems. Proportional representation, voting system. If you're going to vote in this thing, and as long as they allow voting to happen, if we're going to vote, then you need to at least have power equal to the percentage of black people that exist here. Don't you think so? And that's throughout the whole system. 16, U.S. out of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Get the hell out. 17, the West must pay its debt to Africa and its descendants. Pay up. 18, free Palestine, down with Israel apartheid. 19, climate change and toxic pollution by capitalism must end. That's what we do. This is ours. And if the Democratic Party wants to adopt this platform, that's up to them. But whether they do or not, our struggle heats up to make this 19-point platform in the national agenda for black political self-determination. This is ours. And this ain't something that you work on every 4 years. This is something we work on every damn day. Every day, you understand? This is our program. Thank you very much, Uhuru.
That was Black is Back Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshetela. Black Agenda Report senior columnist Margaret Kimberly was one of the speakers at the conference. Kimberly said self-determination means breaking with the warmongering, corporate control, mass incarcerating Democratic Party.
This country promotes the quadrennial duopoly sham for the express purpose of closing off our options, of giving us the impression that there is no other way to be political actors. Let us remember our own history in the demonstrations, sit-ins, teach-ins, freedom schools, and rebellions that changed our lives for the better. But that's why we're being urged to forget those days. If we live up to that legacy, we might just say the world is round and that we won't fall off if we get rid of the Democrats once and for all. Now, if you want to know what self-determination looks like, just notice what's happening in Standing Rock, North Dakota. The steadfastness of the people there and their allies has made a difference. Obama said he's now considering the possibility of rerouting that pipeline that will threaten their water supplies and their sacred sites. And if this does happen, it won't be out of the goodness of his heart. It will be because people fought back. There was no election. There was just a fight, a sustained fight. And for the record, let's just talk about how bad our country is. We have more people incarcerated and a greater percentage of our population incarcerated than any other country on earth. Last year, at least 1,100 people, an average of 3 every day, were killed by the police. And none of those police were successfully prosecuted. And that is the definition of fascism. And I believe I heard Omali say you define fascism as white people fearing they'll be treated like black people. Am I correct? Is that what you said? So Trump can't bring fascism here because we already have it. Fascism, however defined, is more than an obnoxious man speaking to a redneck audience. It can be smooth-talking Ivy Leaguers who buy in, support, and get money from some of the worst people in the world. And exercising self-determination also means being discerning about the information you receive. If there's an unrelenting media attack on a person or nation, you must assume that the U.S. government is telling lies and is up to no good. So I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the bogeyman in this election, Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. Is there anything not blamed on Putin? And you may not know anything about him or Russia, but I can assure you of a couple of things. One, the corporate media take their cues from the White House. If the White House suddenly said that flowers came out of Vladimir Putin's backside, the New York Times would say so too. When they say he is Satan, they're repeating administration talking points word for word. But it's the U.S. that has provoked and instigated every conflict with that country. We know that the U.S. abetted the coup against the elected president of Ukraine, a country which borders Russia. Would an American president say nothing if Putin instigated a coup in Mexico or Canada? Of course not. Let's recall what happened with Grenada, a tiny island in the Caribbean, which chose to ally itself with Cuba, and they were crushed. But this history is too inconvenient to be remembered. Instead, the U.S. goes on a spree of destruction around the world, and Russia and others are left to react and try to protect themselves as best they can. In Syria, American-backed terrorists from ISIS and al-Nusra, that's al-Qaeda, by the way, are holding the people of East Aleppo and other cities hostage. But what are Americans told? That President Assad is a modern-day Hitler and Putin is his friend Hitler Jr. This war has been going on for 5 years. After Hillary Clinton destroyed Libya and laughed about killing Gaddafi. By the way, Reagan, someone mentioned it, tried to kill Gaddafi, but it's a Democrat who did it. So the U.S. never cared about any other nation's democratic efforts. So even if it were true that Russia was hijacking our election, it would be nothing more than the pot meeting the kettle. So who's the fascist? When we march, we say this is what democracy looks like. When we meet together today, we are showing the world what self-determination looks like. Voting for our enemies is not self-determination. Believing what they print and broadcast is not self-determination. Thinking that electoral politics is the only road to liberation is not self-determination. And we don't even have to have all the answers or know all the steps that we're going to take. But we certainly should know what we should stop doing. And on Wednesday, after someone has declared the president-elect, our struggle will not be over. We know that the fight to determine our fate won't end. And whoever is inaugurated in January must be shown what the fight for liberation and self-determination looks like. Thank you very much.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.